wanted to explain to one of the members, Father Lockhart has presented silently from meeting at 2.
We continue with answers questions. We start at question 869, and the questioner is the Honourable Eric Yanni.
Mr. Speaker, as of the 9th of November 2016, the County Government displayed how many social care workers employed by the care agency were physically working with social care workers at each of the following establishments: such as rising homes, children's homes, and rehabilitation services.
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I am uncertain as to what the Honourable Gentleman means by questioning whether social care workers are physically working as social care workers. Is the Honourable Gentleman asking whether social care workers work remotely by digital means?
Mr. Speaker, what I'm asking is, of the social care workers who are employed by the agency, how many were physically in attendance at those establishments on that particular day?
Mr. Speaker, that is not what I understood from the Honourable Gentleman at all. If you wanted a headcount of a particular day, that is not what I have read the question to ask you. But what he wants is to know how many care workers were actually at Dr. Girardi's Children's Home and Rehabilitation Services. I'll get that information for you.
I think it's obvious, but could I suggest, in the first place, Honourable Ministers or whoever in their department first the question, they're not talking about the meaning of a question, then, and they're not able to contact the Honourable Member of the Opposition who has asked that question, but they inform my staff here in Parliament, and we will endeavour, by any means, we will endeavour to ascertain what is behind the question immediately. If there is a need to rephrase it, we will exercise our good offices in that respect. I think it's obvious, but perhaps it's something that is worth keeping in mind. Okay?
The Honourable Gentleman must have the actual complement of postal workers in each of these three institutions. It's a headcount, yes, a headcount. The Honourable Gentleman is asking me how many people were physically working there on that day. I'm getting the headcount. He's not asking me for the complement. I'm giving everything the positive. Mr. Speaker, if what they want is a physical headcount as of the time, as of the 9th of November, I will ask my staff to actually go through their records and determine how many people were physically working. If they want to know what the complement is, they can look at the book of estimates. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, on the last question time, notwithstanding that the answer to the question of the Honourable Gentleman is in the book of estimates, I gave the answer to the Honourable Mr. Trevor Hammond. So, they're asking me a question which I could have answered by saying, look to the public document. I don't do that. I actually compare the documentation and I give it to them. They ask me the same question, but at a particular date, and they want the information again. Mr. Speaker, we have to be serious about the business we conduct in Parliament.
I'm sorry, but this particular question has never been asked before.
And if I would, this particular question has been asked
by the Honourable Trevor Hammond on behalf of the Honourable Lauren Jammer. Only last time.
Not on this particular day. Now, I've used the term compliment, and if I've used the term compliment wrongly, I apologise. But the actual question is clear on the face of the question. Now, I was just asking, will the Honourable Gentleman have the actual figures? Then you have it where it looks. You will have to ask it next time round. But I have to say to the Honourable Gentleman, with respect, this meeting has not started, nobody's intended to start this meeting on a bad foot, and you shouldn't take it so personally. that I have made a comment using the term compliment, you know, the way that he has taken it.
Having delayed the sitting of Parliament and having to come here in your right. There are a number of questions here which I perceive could be, I want to phrase the thing very diplomatically, as diplomatically as possible, which could give rise to some exchanges, let us say. So let's see whether we can start off on a good basis. The main point is this: if there is any doubt on the part of the minister or whoever is drafting an answer on the minister's behalf, when that person sees the original question, if there is any doubt, inform the staff here in Parliament, we will try to clear up the doubt immediately. And therefore we can and then the question can be rephrased by the clerk or by even I myself sometimes. I was here last time dealing with the questions. The question can be rephrased in order to make it absolutely clear as to what it is that the honourable questioner is after. So let's see if we can keep the temperature down for the rest of this meeting.
Question number 870, the Honourable Alex Young.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide details of how many people with disabilities attend establishments in Spain on a daily basis and for what purpose?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid that the way that the answer is just that may raise attention to explanatory law. Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid I am also unable to answer this question, as we're not in a position to inform the site who, whether, when, or for what purpose, persons with disabilities attend establishments in Spain. The Care Agency does not have access to data or records in respect of the type of information the Honourable Gentleman requests.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not asking for specific papers of state details, sorry, of who actually attends the services. Perhaps if I rephrase in a supplementary, the minister will be able to answer. Are there any service users who would normally attend establishment series of also who do go to Spain on a daily or weekly basis to another sense of across the border?
Speaker, I'm afraid that I wouldn't know if the service user is also knew that they established the same thing that we asked for.
So, therefore, Mr. Speaker, is the Minister then saying that there are no service users who are being funded access to those service centres across the border?
No, I'm not saying that.
Yes, but Mr. Speaker, therein lies the point. The Honourable Gentleman, I quite understand that the Honourable Gentleman may come to this house and may say, I don't know who is using services in Spain if the government doesn't fund it, because this is a private, entirely private initiative by private individuals. But if the government is funding, then of course the government must know. Now, does he not have any information as to how many service users are actually being funded in order to use institutions in Spain? That is something that the government ought to be capable of answering.
Yeah, Mr. Speaker, I have, again, in the last section of this house, answered the question of how many adults with learning disabilities receive care outside of Spain, and within the information that I provided to the Honourable Mr. Hannan in the absence of the Honourable Mr. Yannis, I noted that there was one with disability to receive care in Spain, and that is in the Bona in Spain.
Question number 871, the Honourable Alex Young.
Mr. Speaker, Ephesians 7:1-7-2015, can the government confirm the three available beds for this person have always been available during the past 5 years, if not on how many occasions and for how long have they not been available?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, in the first instance, I refer the Honourable Gentleman to answer 772 to receive the results. In my answer, I noted that there are four available beds for respite, comprising of three beds and one bed for emergency. Further, Mr. Speaker, to know that the following date highlight period, there are less than three beds were available for respite. During January of this year to March of this year, there were two beds available for respite, and during the end of November 2016 to date, two respite beds are available for respite. If I may just add, Mr. Speaker, anticipating the supplementary question of the Honourable Gentleman, the Honourable Lady, Samantha Sacramento, has very kindly been able to provide to the disability services a satellite flat in the community, so that I am told by way of supplementary information that by the 23rd of December, there should be once again, in 2 days' time, there could once again be the four beds available for the fund.
Question number 872, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Can the government advise how many accidents have been reported in respect of the use of the escalators at St. Bernard's Hospital in Florence?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, one incident has been reported. Mr. Speaker, I'm very grateful to the Honourable Minister for his answer. Can I ask him if the escalators are now permanently, have they been permanently shut down for safety reasons? Certainly, I tried to use them the other day and they were not operational.
Mr. Speaker, in the first instance, I would suggest the Honourable Gentleman would walk up. It is a good exercise.
In the second place, I would tell the Honourable Gentleman that the escalators are not permanently open.
Mr. Speaker, if the Minister of Front and Self needed just this afternoon, I tried to use the escalators when I was going for an x-ray for my foot, and therefore I entered as a patient. But since you told me I could walk up and do a good exercise, maybe you'll tell that to the rest of the people in the water.
Mr. Speaker, I noticed that the Senior Citizens Association have an issue with the escalators, and are going to trying to meet with the Minister in order to discuss an alternative list. Speaker, I asked the Minister if he seems to be considering replacing the escalators with a lift, and therefore removing the escalators, or even proposing to install a lift somewhere else. And would he therefore agree that the escalators were perhaps a bad idea in the first place?
In the first place, I have not yet asked the Honourable Gentleman to have any lift yet, because he has suffered major injuries, in which case, of course, the lift would have been more suitable in the circumstances. The Honourable Gentleman is right. I believe the Senior Association have asked for a meeting. I am in fact, I bumped into Mr. Hayes today for a meeting, if I recall correctly, that he is going to meet on the 2nd or the 3rd week of January, in the event that the DHA would accept the proposal of a list, it would be additional to. And therefore, no, we do not think that it was a bad idea to include the escalator, whereas certainly having an accident is regrettable. I do not think that the fact of one accident diminishes the benefits and diminishes that the escalator has meant to the many patients that need it.
This is Peter Reynolds, the Honourable Minister for Answer. Can you indicate what problem is with the escalator? Will it be back in operation soon, or is it operational today?
Mr. Speaker, the escalator should have been operational yesterday, and they were not today. They assure me they will be operational today before the end of the week.
Question number 873, the Honourable Aaron Pinnock.
Mr. Speaker, can the government now advise to whom the contract has been awarded in respect of the mental daycare centre?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, a preferred bidder has been identified and notified. The GHO is in discussions and I expect to make an announcement soon.
Mr. Speaker, I may ask on the Minister. I wouldn't say shortly, could have been notified.
Mr. Speaker, I recall the time when I asked, as a member of the opposition, what sorts of meant, and I will refer to the Honourable Gentleman to Hansard and the answer that the Speaker gave me at the time. But I will be infinitely more helpful and tell him that I expect to be able to make an announcement in the first week of January.
Question number 874, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm that the contract for the Residential Dementia Centre is still held by Grand Home Care?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the contract in relation to the Dementia Care Home is to answer this question in the affirmative, yes.
Question number 875, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, does the government have an anticipated opening date for the Residential Dementia Centre and the Dementia Daycare Centre, and why have there been so many delays in their opening?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the delays in respect of the Dementia Care Home have come as a result of the building not being handed over by the contractor. I'm delighted to note, as I said in my previous question, that I will be in a position to announce the opening of the Dementia Day Centre shortly and the proceedings to have been done in the first week of January.
I'm grateful to the Honourable Minister for answering. Can I ask, when says the buildings are handled by the contractor, is that in respect of the residential centre, but the daycare centre has been handed over, we could perhaps eliminate on that point?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, that's why I preface my answer and say that the delays in respect of the dementia care home has been able to be held for building not being handed over by the contractor, and then specifically we will be announcing the opening of the Dementia Day Centre shortly. So the delay in respect of the contractor relates solely to the Dementia Care Centre.
This is still a record to the Honourable Minister. The obvious question really is, has the building now been handed over to the government in respect to the Dementia Residential Centre?
I'm afraid not to speak.
Mr. Speaker, this is somewhat concerning to hear that it hasn't been handed over, since you obviously have a contract to the service provider, and yet the building is not ready, and then conversely, you have the building ready for the daycare centre, but no service provider as yet. What is it that caused the delay in the contractor to hand over the dementia centre? And this is something, as we all know, of great concern to service community, the central service community and our families. I find it somewhat concerning to hear today that the building itself has not been handed over. Where I perhaps have been mistakenly under the assumption it was a question of putting together the services and the support staff necessary to operate in the centre. And so can the Minister advise what the problem is with the building?
The information that I have for him is that the contractors will hand over before April.
they should be sufficiently consumed with the service of God. So we're talking about local staple of the sin.
Mr. Speaker, I would, I'm very good to know the answer. I would invite him to perhaps communicate, or maybe hasn't communicated already, communicate this to the relevant stakeholders in respect of the residential care. Because there's also an expectation in the community that I think as a viewpoint program, which will hopefully come into being in January, I haven't appreciated that this is solely an aspect of the daycare center. I would invite him to advise the relevant stakeholders so they can manage their expectations accordingly. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, yes, the Cynic in me notes that April is obviously after the 31st of March, which is the end of the financial year. Is the fact that this is going to be handed over in April to do with the fact that the government has spent so much money over the last 5 years, $750 million in capital projects alone, that unfortunately there isn't enough in the kitchen for this to be opened earlier?
No, Mr. Speaker, he is a cynic, but I can assure him that the information that has been accompanied to me from the professionals at the EOS and at the DHS is that it has only to do with the handling of the building by the contractor. It has nothing to do with financing. On the contrary, I am, as you can imagine, giving intense stress to open as soon as is humanly possible, and as you can also imagine, that also with the buyer on this side of the building. So, the living should be happy that the cynicism could be dispelled if only for a few hours this afternoon.
Mr. Speaker, coming back to the question of the residential dementia centre and the fact that Grand Home Care have the contract, can the Minister confirm that the government is not paying any form of retention until the period of which the building is handed over to the government, but otherwise there is going to be paying for service which cannot be used by anyone? And how do you expect Grand Home Care to manage the interim in terms of recruitment?
Mr. Speaker, there's also two supplementaries. In respect of the first one, I will need to check the documentation of it. I would find it incredibly odd if it was any government for anything. And I certainly, my honourable friend, Dr. Professor, said that setting up in his time, I can assure him that setting up in my time either. So I think we can, but I will probably get back to him in any event. To say his concern, and have him listen with me. So it was my own concern that we're not affecting any kind of work ever until the opening of the dementia campaign. And in respect of the whether the contractor will be able to recruit sufficiently quickly to be able to ensure that the services may be provided. Whereas I didn't sit in the board, the selection board, I do not expect that one of the final questions put to the contractor would be that when it's open, you know, by the time that we tell you within a 7-meeting period, you would be in a position to be able to deliver so many nurses, etc. And the answer clearly must have been because, whereas I don't have information with me, there will have been various companies that would have bid for that particular, and the board would have, I need to assume, would have been extremely rigorous, and one of the main issues would have been, would you be able to deliver, provide the professional staff to be able to deliver these services once the zone opens. And I can see that the professor is not going to next to me, so we can also be assured of that.
If I can just confirm that I understood the Honourable Minister correctly, he suggested that services will commence the day after the building is handed over by the contractor, so presumably all other provision will be in place for that date.
I didn't say the day after the building is handed over. What I said was, what I read out, which was that we would be able to proceed straight after that. In other words, the recruitment and the systems that need to be in place, with equipment and so on, will be in place by then. And we just need to make sure, of course, that when the building is handed over, that there is no to support my assistance. So essentially, when the building is handed over, there has to be cleaning, furnishing, and that's what the thing we need for the building to make sure that it's safe and that the work that's been constructed to be carried out has been carried out. So very shortly after the building is handed over to the government.
Question number 876, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Speaker, does the government agree that we need to look towards targeted and specialised training for social workers, the judiciary and legal professions so that we can ensure that we recognise cases of parental alienation syndrome early on?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman will be happy to know that the Children's Services already work under the auspices of the Children and Families Court Advisory and Support Services, CAFCAS support. The Children's Services continue to work in accordance with CAFCAS best practices. The Court Welfare Team has both developed and administered the co-parenting programme to deal with parental alienation. This is the first created and produced and presented to the Supreme Court for its perusal and recommendations in 2004. The co-parenting program ranges from 6 to 10 sessions for each client, depending on necessity, testimony level of alienation has been assessed. Sessions are structured and run individually with each client and further consist of joint work with both ex-partners at the beginning and at the end of the program. The context of mediation is spoken. Sessions initially present the purpose and importance of co-parenting, and importantly, the impact and abusive nature of acrimony and alienation to the child or children involved. This is reinforced throughout the session. The therapeutic and the co-parenting team work together and deliver the co-parenting program to families involved in acrimony separation and divorce cases. They have been delivering this program for almost 14 years. The court makes recommendations for such programs to be delivered to families. The program continues to be reviewed and updated by the care agencies, social worker and psychologist. Both have significant experience in this field. It's important to highlight that the social worker attended further mediation training in September. Both practitioners recognize that there has been an increase in the parental alienation syndrome. The care agency, therefore, in the process of arranging a meeting with the Supreme Court judges to discuss these issues. I should further note, Mr. Speaker, that the psychologist, as well as the social worker, are aware that constitutes emotional abuse as a result of parental alienation. Emotional harm, per se, is already a key component of the safeguarding training. The care agency psychologist has been delivering this training to frontline professionals approximately for the past 10 years. The Supreme Court judge's ruling in the two most recent testimonies in complex cases commended both social workers and the psychologists involved for their assessment, evidence, and recommendations. Further, training for lawyers may curb the increasing trend in parental alienation for a better and more thorough understanding. I will seek to raise the issue with the Bar Council at our next meeting. I also intend to raise this issue with the Honourable the Chief Justice at our next meeting. Finally, the care agency has advised me of a sure way to decrease parental alienation. Alienation is a proposal which the Honourable Gentleman may well dislike, and it is as simple as implementing a test on legal assistance for divorce proceedings. The premise of the advice is that unlimited legal assistance results in cases of parental manipulation and, in some instances, some lawyers' inability to prevent cases from escalating. I think the Minister.
If I may just add that that is not a proposal that I am seeking to implement.
I'm not sure I want to comment on the limited caps in relation to those measures, but I think it's right, and I welcome the suggestion that the Chief Justice will be in contact, but I also welcome further training for family lawyers in this field, because those are the ones that particularly at the front line when it comes to divorces and issues affecting their own children. But I have it quite regularly now. I would say on a daily basis, fathers approach me with this issue, and the heartache clearly from them is that when their children come to them for access, there is this vitriol which is being transferred from the mother in this particular example to the father, and which it calls a very difficult access arrangements between the father and the children. My understanding is we're not doing enough as a community to deal with parental alienation, and that's why I've raised it in Parliament, that's why I've raised it outside this house as well, in order to improve awareness in relation to parental alienation. In the United Kingdom, for example, I understand that in all divorce cases, 11% and 15% of divorce cases deal with hard parental alienation, but I would welcome very much for the family for everybody to take this family charge. And what I would say is, I just wanted to know really when this meeting with the law and with the justice government would realize when that would happen. I think in the first place, to say to the legal gentleman, although it's my and can't believe it's been 5 years since I was in private practice, I do personally recall acting as a finance assistant and there being clear instances of parental manipulation. And unfortunately, in my case, it happened to be the dad who would suffer mostly because they would be the person who did not have children with them at home, and therefore conjugal relations had to be arranged. I do recall witnessing that particular emotional heartache, and I agree with one of the gentlemen as well. I think therefore have voted, but as I've also said, the central accreditation also concerns me that there has been an increase in the parental alienation syndrome, and this is why I have agreed, further to the other gentleman raising this by way of his own article, to raise the matter with the Honourable Chief Justice at the next meeting. I will speak to include in the agenda, for the Chief Justice, I will discuss it with him. And similarly, I have various meetings meeting with the Bar Council in respect of separate matters, but at the very first meeting with them, or they were meeting to discuss a certain item, I will also speak to that item for failing in relation to law. I have to say that I did try to politely inquire as to whether or not Supreme Court judges had thought any additional training in respect of parental alienation. They have not. That does not mean to say that they would not like it. It would be excellent. It would be why I should raise it with the other Chief Justice in the next week. If one takes me helpful, I'm quite happy to work with the other Chief Justice. I'm quite happy to attend meetings as well with the Chief Justice that help. It's a matter which I think is really important. Particularly when it revolves around the defensive issue of children and their ability to access either one of the parents that's been alienated. But I would say as well that there is a link here, a very strong link towards parental alienation syndrome and the failure of a certain parent, particularly the father in many instances, who pay many instances. I wonder whether the ministry has any thought as to how we can enforce those arrangements and have greater protection for the mothers who are not being paid their monthly maintenance. And we'll add to the court for the agreement. Speaker, before Mr. Hughes, the honourable gentleman read my mind, while giving him my answer to the separate two separate questions, I always used to advise my clients that there was a certain amount which the former partner, the former spouse had asked for, but to show good will and good faith, there was a type of seed that amount where those persons that these parties allowed. There are already mechanisms in place through the United States Court. The Allen Corporate with the former Minister of Justice, the introduced a civil fact that introduced those mechanisms. So the legal mechanisms exist. The question is, are they being enforced? That is certainly something that I would be more than happy to look into.
Mr. Speaker,
are we not simply talking about parents? We're also talking about grandparents, because grandparents are often there's fallout in relation to the grandparents, and any parental alienation towards the father, for example, is often translated also to the grandparent. That's one of the reasons why in the Children's Act we included, which are a little different from the United Kingdom, the footprints for England, I beg your pardon, in Wales. Not Scotland, the same as ours, we included as well the right for grandparents to apply for access to their grandchildren, which is admitted to English in the US.
I'd invite the Honourable the Minister for Justice to obviously extend that to them as well, because here in poor communities like Gibraltar, where grandparents play such a pivotal role in the family, the extended family, that they should not be alienated. But let me ask this, turn it into this question. Parental alienation is multifaceted, it is something that I grappled with when I was Minister for Justice, one of the reasons why we introduced the children back in 2009. But it not only needs training, but it also needs the facilities as well. And a critical and crucial facility in order to allow social services to help with the question of parental alienation is a family centre. Because very often what happens is that the alienation gets to such an extent that the children just simply do not want to sit and see the father or the grandparents. So the only way that they can have any kind of contact is in a family centre. Now, we asked in January about the family centre when that was coming online, and we were told that it was going to be imminent. And I wonder whether that is something that the Honourable the Minister for Justice can also shed some light, because that is absolutely critical in a situation where the children just simply do not want to see the father, and obviously there is no other way of doing it other than through, unfortunately, supervised justice.
Mr. Speaker, yes, the Honourable Gentleman is right that sometimes there needs to be a neutral ground for parents to see the children to whom they have contact. He is right. To say that it has to be a family centre exclusively is not correct, though. Now, while we have already announced in the Parliament that we are in the process of having a family centre, we already have, as I have said in Parliament before, alternative premises which we are using for those purposes. So while the Honourable Gentleman is right in saying what he's saying, in answer to that, by way of assistance to my Honourable friend, is that that is already happening. And I have already mentioned this in the Parliament before. We have a premises which we are using to a family centre, which is outside the social services building. Of course, the social services building itself within it has now rooms which we have refurbished, so they don't look like they did before. They look more comfortable and warmer and less institutional. So that is perfectly acceptable for these purposes of a neutral ground. But even beyond that, we have other government premises and facilities which we are using, which is which are quite anonymous, and it is not widely known that it is used for these purposes other than the people for whom this is being used, for obvious reasons, because of course as part of this we want it to be discreet. But in addition to that, and further to that, we are nevertheless developing another premises which we have identified for this purpose.
Because the reason why I mentioned the family centre is because we need the Children's Act. The Children's Act refers to a statutory obligation in terms of a family centre. It's not some other kind of building, it's a family centre. And further, the reason why I mentioned the family centre was because I was asked about this during the last election in the Mackintosh Hall, there was a discussion in relation to this, and the government has consistently said that family centre will be provided online, compliant with the Children's Act, imminently, we were told, in January. And I just wondered how imminent that was now, having reached December of 2016.
Mr. Speaker, the statute is not prescriptive in the sense that it says there has to be a room that is this size and has this and has that and the other. What the statute provides for is that the government provides a facility for a family centre. Now, as the Honourable Gentleman I'm sure knows, a family centre is more of a concept than a physical building. But in any event, we provide this already in a location that we have that is used as government premises, that is used as social services. As you call Mr. Speaker, when we once had this in response to this question, the Honourable Gentleman suggested that while they were in government, they were considering having an area in the Lower Thames. We don't want it, when it was my responsibility, I didn't actually put that as an appropriate location, and it's be somewhat more discreet. And we are using a more discreet centre at the moment, and I am certainly satisfied that we are providing for what needs to be done under the requirement of the children act, especially for people we are not looking at vast numbers of children who require the service. But nevertheless, what we are planning is something that will enhance the facility which we already have. I understand, I cannot give a specific data for the people who are no longer involved with that, but I'm sure that the coming online of the new facility, which will be used for a family centre, and will kind of be followed.
I just understand that obviously you're trying to meet the needs of your manifesto commitment where you state that that will continue to ensure that this doesn't quickly in the best way to be able to deliver the requirements of children, including the setting up of the family centres required by the Act. Your commitment still is to set up, as it states, that there's no school in the manifesto, a family centre, albeit that it seems to be slightly different to what you're saying now in terms of the resources that you currently have and working towards it. Just to clarify.
Yes, Mr. Peter, just to clarify, what I have said is that while we prepare the family centre, which is the building that we envisage to be used as a family centre, we already provide alternative premises which are being used for the purposes of a family centre at the moment. So that the one that will come online will be even better. But I'm saying that what we're doing now with the new premises that we have are already compliant both with the manifesto commitment and with the responsibility under the legislation, which is that we will have another one and a different one coming on stream next hour.
Question number 827, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government explain their policy for the use of CCTV in public areas in the world?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 878, 879, and question 880.
Question number 878, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government confirm whether or not it has received complaints regarding the use of CCTV from members of the public, and can the government give details of those complaints?
Question number 879, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government explain what measures are in place to ensure that the use of CCTV does not infringe civil liberties?
Question number 880, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government explain how CCTV, still images and video are shared with law enforcement agencies?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the government's policy objectives, as set out at paragraph 4 of the Public CCTV Code of Practice, and the basis for the processing of data are to enhance community safety, reduce the fear of crime, deter and detect crime, and deter and detect acts of antisocial behaviour. Complaints against police officers made by members of the general public are lodged with the Police Complaint Board, the PCB. All complaints made to the PCB are fully investigated and logged by the RCP's Professional Standards Department. The RCP has not logged any complaints against police due to misuse of the public CCTV system. Government's public CCTV system is managed by Royal Board Police from Nemo House. In its management of the system, the RCP applies its public CCTV code of practice. The aim of this policy is to provide a clear framework for the operation and control of all public CCTV systems in Gibraltar, highlighting what it will be used for and ensuring that evidence is secured, retained, and made available as required so there is absolute respect for everyone's rights. Furthermore, the CCTV system is designed to ensure it blocks out any potential intrusion by automatically blocking out areas of the video feed for a camera angle to potentially intrude into a private dwelling or other location that is private. The operating system is accredited by the Department, by the Office of the Data Protection Commissioner before being launched. The public CCTV system is operated by the Royal Board of Police, which is the primary law
law enforcement agencies in Malta, insofar as the use of a public CCTV system applies, and therefore the need for sharing would not ordinarily arise. If there is a need to share upon request of another of the Malta law enforcement agencies, this will be done in strict compliance with the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act, the Data Protection Act, and the RGP's public CCTV code of practice.
Mr. Speaker, I remind just ask the Honourable Minister, I am aware that the Department of the Environment does or certainly has sent out CCTV images when finding people for listening, for instance, particularly in residential estates. Is it the case that the RGPD team and share CCTV images with the Department of the Environment, or how does that department obtain those images?
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Dr. Kotecki speaks to his question in respect of whether the environmental agency shares the information or whether the agency shares with environment. In respect of whether we routinely share, just to remind the House of what I've just said, which is that the system is operated by the RGP, which is the final law enforcement agency in charge of the use of public CCTV system applies, and the need for sharing does not ordinarily arise. If there is a need to share upon request, then the sharing is done in strict compliance with the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act, the Data Protection Act, and the RGP's public CCTV code of conduct.
The Department of the Environment and the Environmental Agency have specific targeted cameras which target, for example, little hotspots and that sort of thing. And that is focused separately using all the legal frameworks, so the system we're using is the same. I don't believe we have ever shared with the police because we have never identified anything of another nature that needed to go to the police, otherwise obviously we would have a duty to report it before the client performed in front of one of these cameras. But the system runs pretty well in parallel, and as I say, they are specifically targeted at the hotspots and the like.
Mr. Speaker, in this case, as there appear to be two separate CCTV networks in operation here, is government aware of any other departments that have their own separate CCTV networks operating in public places?
Mr. Speaker, no, given that these questions are specific about the RGP code of practice and so on, I don't know the answer. If there is a difference to the United Kingdom, I suspect it will probably be from private estates and indeed security companies and so on. But certainly, as far as I am aware, the answer is no, and my honourable colleagues could jump in to contradict me if I know.
Let me just really just one further question. The reason I asked that further question before, of course, is relating to the incident with the runner at the front or whether it pushed the car across the customs pushed the car right across the side on the front side. And one of the issues was that this CCTV came into public domain. Clearly, there must have been some form of, I think there's some form of print design investigation in relation to the use of that CCTV and the posting it on Facebook and other social media.
The customs is my responsibility, and it's an answer that the registered investigation into the whole issue of whether to continue proceedings should be taken on.
So just away from the answer to that question, is it the fact that the RGP has linked CCTV footage to customs in those particular sites? And if that's the case, then there is a different CCTV system in relation to foreign customs.
with the Honourable Gentleman for the debate to that question. I don't think it arises from the question. I'm going to give an answer which may or may not be correct.
I said, can the government explain how specific sharing of individuals is shared with the law enforcement agencies? So quite clearly, there's a sharing of specific information between the relevant law enforcement agencies. It's a good idea, but that was the nature of the question, therefore it's within the remit of the answer.
The speaker of the supplementary is not about that. The supplementary is about what the specific system the government has. And the government, I can say off the top of my head, has a CCTV system around the number 6 common bridge, which doesn't belong to any of the enforcement agencies. But if something goes wrong in the area around number 6, it is provided to the law enforcement agencies. The only thing in supplementary is what CCTV system the government has. Well, you know, to give them an accurate answer, I'm not saying we're not going to answer it, you need to give them a that question.
But Mr. Speaker, certainly customs have their own system, and customs that I would classify customs as law enforcement. Can you confirm that? I think at least you can confirm that.
Mr. Speaker, I'm very grateful for the concession from the DSC that customs is a law enforcement agency, because for the 60 years that they were in government, customs found that they were not regarded as a law enforcement agency. It was a big issue of contention. Well, I understand, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman has a completely different view now that he is the leader of the new DSC, so the position he needs to take when he is a Minister for Justice, responsible for law enforcement in the DSC, about what legal is not a law enforcement agency. But I have come to the conclusion that this chameleonic approach to every policy subject is one that we have to expect from the Honourable Gentleman. Customs is a law enforcement agency, and it has to continue to be.
Question number 881, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
Mr. Speaker,
does the government plan to conduct a staff morale survey within the entirety of the DHA or parts thereof? Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, in the first place, I wish to reiterate that obviously I have the highest respect for all clinicians and the incredible vital public service that they provide. There can be no question of that. As I've also said, I intend to leave no stone unturned and spare no effort in ensuring that I build on my predecessor's formidable legacy and improve where we can the quality of the services that we deliver. I'm currently engaging as widely and as thoroughly as possible with all stakeholders to make sure that we get things exactly right. I'm currently systematically meeting with all levels of management, and until I have completed all of my meetings, I will not be in a position to determine if there's a need for another survey. What I can assure the House is I intend to make sure that all genuine concerns brought to my attention are investigated and appropriate action is taken.
Mr. Speaker, does the Honourable Gentleman accept that there is a morale problem, particularly at the hospital, amongst them?
Mr. Speaker, we ventilated these issues in public by our press releases, but we also did in the House and delighted to engage. In the first place, the Honourable Gentleman in the press release, which was delightful by brevity, but for no other reason of content, failed to mention that the sample of doctor consulted do not include the DCs. And you must accept that if there is going to be a morale survey of an institution, and we want to know how people are feeling in terms of morale, then we need to include the consultants and the DC doctors. And it does not make sense to have an informal documentation asked with only ask the question of a particular group. So there are 13 people asked of a total of 82 people. He fails to mention in his brief press statement that notwithstanding what he said, 61% of the 30 doctors that were asked the question, 61% said they did not see low or morale. Now, I've also said, I genuinely do not want this to become a partisan issue because I think Tim and I both agree that the health services provide an excellent service. They have to be non-political to the extent that he and I will need medical care at many different points of our lives, and the care has to be provided to the best quality irrespective of political status. Since I took over as Minister for Health, I am meeting systematically, methodically, it's going to take sometime to meet with all levels of management and also commission, master, and everyone that would clearly have an opinion as to how the GHA is working. I also need to make the point that, my ministry is not the GHA. That my ministry is separate to the GHA, although of course my ministry and the GHA have to work hand in glove in respect of how medical services are delivered. And I'm going to leave it there because I don't want to get into the type of questions that were asked, how they were asked, and whether they would elicit other things by, have they been phrased differently. So I would proceed to say that in a government entity as large as the GHA, there will undoubtedly be pockets where people will not be entirely satisfied with the way that they have that management has dealt with them. And I think it was an opinion piece that said that management does have to walk sometimes an accessible cycle between the demands of the patient and perhaps what professionals and clinicians may be willing to be able to provide an particular clinical capacity with movement. And management needs to always set that balance between clinicians, professionals, nurses, and professionals and the demands of the patient. So as I said, I don't want to leave the house thinking that I have dismissed the idea of another morale survey. All I'm saying is that until I conclude my own meeting with all clinicians and allied service nurses, I cannot commit to that because it may be that the issues that they raise with me are issues that can be dealt with answer.
Thank you very much for the answer. The point about the survey conducted by the doctors, I think that it's been left on the honourable gentleman. Because when he says that it's only a sample of 31 doctors out of a total complement of 81, the reality is that it was a survey conducted of the doctors at the hospital, not the entirety of the GHA. And it was never represented as a survey of all the doctors in the GHA. It was a survey of the doctors at the hospital. At the hospital. Even if it had been otherwise, 38% or 36%, I can't recall the exact percentage of what it equates to, is a very high sample indeed. Did he not think at the very least, that the fact that doctors have gone to the extent of conducting and participating in a survey of this nature at the hospital, that it does indicate that perhaps there is a level of discontent amongst doctors at the hospital that obviously is something that needs to be looked at. I ask you for more supplementaries and move on to more substantial issues.
Mr. Speaker, on the basis that I did come in into this house, given that I arrived late, I would allow the Honourable Gentleman to have said to me that I point has been lost, but that's the only one I'm going to allow him to get. The point has not been lost on me, because I told him that notwithstanding that in my view the result has to be skewed, he and we accept at its highest this informal documentation. Let's say that he and I agree that it was perfectly proper for this doctor to simply consult the 30 consultants and leave everyone else out. I don't agree that he should have done so, leaving the GP down. But let's say that I agree with him for the sake of argument. He seems not to want to remember, and he's having that rather especially, that of those polls, and irrespective of my concerns as to how the questions were asked, because he knows it about them, that if he wants to put words into somebody's mouth, he asks a closed question. Yes, he asked a closed question. The question wasn't asked, how would you portray morale at the GHA? Excellent. Very good. Good. Get me out of here. That's not how it was defended. The only reputable polling company will tell you that to achieve an accurate assessment of anything, you need to ask open questions. Because the moment that you ask a skewed, loaded question, you are more or less
entirely satisfied with something. And those questions are being done face to face, not anonymously, with open questions, you know, proper scientific methodology.
May I say both honourable members, both the minister, and any other member of the Woods to our supplementary, that I am not going to allow exchanges or a debate on the appropriateness of this survey. It is the subject of the question. The matter has been amply ventilated outside Parliament. I am allowing a certain latitude in the exchanges, but we are not going to have a debate about whether certain questions were appropriate, the manner in which the survey was carried out, or the reason for authenticity, or what have you. I'm not going to allow a debate on that. So I think the Honourable Minister should stick to the question that he has been asked, because I am not going to allow the opposition either to widen the ambit of their question.
I did say my first answer that I wish to be entirely clear of looking into the methodology structure of the survey. And so having said what I said, after your intervention, speaker, I will leave it at that. But the point of discussion was that even accepting the survey at its highest, 61% of those polled, 61% said that they were not low on morale. Not part of the supplementary question to me, not part of the question. And the speaker, there has never been more engagement and consultation between management and the doctors than under my predecessor, Dr. John Cortez. That is no, Mr. Speaker. That is not no. But the Medical Advisory Committee, the 62 creature named specifically to consult doctors and consultants and surgeons and nurses and allied professionals did not meet under the GC. He did not know that.
No, but that is.
Then, Mr. Speaker, the answer is no, sir.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I have to say that I find the answer difficult. Bear in mind that we have this survey that indicates that 94% thought that there was a problem with or were dissatisfied with management at the DHA, and 74% thought that morale was low amongst doctors within the hospital. But perhaps moving on to potential solutions and looking towards the future. And bear in mind that we are spending an awful lot of money on the health service. And these projections are likely to reach about £120 million a year, which is £10 million per month. And therefore, we should be getting much more higher satisfaction ratings for the amount of money that we're actually spending. And worse benefits, because that's an area where we should be spending money. But does the Honourable Gentleman envisage that the government might conduct in the future some kind of root and branch review, particularly of what is happening at the hospital, to see what areas can be improved and to make sure that the public gets value for money and to make sure that there is a better morale at the hospital among staff than is at present the case?
The Honourable Gentleman clearly did not care to listen to my answer. I said that I was currently engaging as widely and thoroughly as possible with all stakeholders to make sure that we get things exactly right. I also told them that I'm currently systematically meeting with all levels of management, and until I have concluded all my meetings, I'm not in a position to determine if there's a need for another survey. I've also told them that if there is any concern or any issue that any commission has, all they need to do is write to me to make sure that I fully investigate any such concern.
Question number 882, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state how many A public servants and B
employees subcontracted through recruitment consultants have as their principal duty the manning of the primary care frontline desk. Answer the Honourable the Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer the question of handling Mr. Speaker.
Question number 883, the Honourable D.A. Fenton. Can the government state how many employees have as their principal duty the manning of the primary care frontline desk? Answer the Honourable the Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
I refer the Honourable Gentleman to answer 353 and 153 of 2016.
Mr. Speaker, prior to asking this question, I've obviously looked back at the questions that I was certainly asked. I can't recall asking this particular question. Unless the Honourable Gentleman has answered it tangentially in relation to another question that has arisen. But perhaps you could draw my attention to the substance of the answer that is given, so that is there any supplementary that I can list in this session of the House?
The Honourable Gentleman asked a question, 252, which I just referred to him. On the 29th of June, so we are within the preceding 6 months. He said, Mr. Speaker, how many workers in state government, government owned companies, authorities, and agencies are currently working in the primary care centre? And the Honourable Representative just gave the answer, and I quote that question with this question: can the government state how many employees have as a principal duty the manning of the primary care frontline desk? They are in all respects. Exactly the same, and then in the previous question, you asked, can the government say how many public servants, which has to mean government employees? So he asked in the 882 how many public servants, and he asked in the 883 how many public servants, and then he says, and B, employees subcontracted. And he asked in question 352 how many workers not employed by government, government-owned companies, authorities, and agencies. I can't work in the family consent, but they are, with respect to the Honourable Gentleman, exactly the same as Oxford. Exactly the same.
With respect to the Honourable Gentleman, unless the answer is this. They're not the same, and I'll tell you, unless the answer is as I'm going to tell you. That question related to all employees in the primary care centre. This relates to the manning of the primary care frontline desk. Now, it would be the same if all the employees working at the primary care centre also manned the frontline desk. But that's a perfectly acceptable answer. But is that what the Honourable Gentleman is telling me the position is? Because the questions that I asked originally were about how many employees, different types of employees, were working at the primary care centre. The question today is about the manning of the primary care frontline desk. I guess everybody works at the frontline desk.
Speaker, I think the issue here is that we read his question differently. The question asked by Mr. Peter 353 was how many workers in the government-owned companies, authorities, agencies are currently working in the primary care centre cancer. I read that as meaning primary care frontline desk. And therefore, that is why I say that the question is already answered. I clarify this quite easily by just referring to my supplementary. Look, the supplementary to 353 was this. I said, so it could not tell us how many of those 11 are actually covering short term maternity, long term illness that he has outlined, and for other reasons. I said, what I'm obviously getting at is he satisfied that we do not have a situation here where there are non-public service employees almost working on a permanent basis in these jobs at the counter in the primary care centre. When the answer came back, the speaker of temporary engagement,
As I have explained before, I do not have a breakdown. I was asked for figures, I have given him figures, I do not have a breakdown. The point was that I asked for, in this question, overall figures. I never asked about the frontline guests, except in a supplementary. And the Honourable Gentleman wasn't able to give me the answer. But we didn't have a breakdown. That's the point. But there's nothing, there is no, Abidan obviously obtained the statistics and see how those resources are being utilized. There's no point having an exchange across the floor of the House in relation to this. If you can provide me with that information, I'd appreciate it. But it hasn't been provided yet, unless the answer to the question is everybody that works at the primary care centre also works at the front line desk. That could be the position, and I don't know.
No, but Mr. Speaker, if that's what he wanted to ask, then this shouldn't be the question either. The only question you should know is that an official will have a job description, but where that is the case, that official may be required to do things that are not necessarily their main primary function. That may, that day, or during a week, or whatever, be at a particular center. And what he wanted to know was how many of the 11 are actually covering short-term maternity. That is an entirely different question.
Mr. Speaker, I'm asking how many employees, public servants, or employees subcontracted to recruitment consultants, have as their principal duty the manning of the primary care frontline desk. Now that's not a question I asked in June, because in June I was asking how many employees were there in the primary care centre. That was in a supplementary. All right, is the answer then there are 11? Is the answer then that there are 11? That's fine. Is that the answer?
No, Mr. Speaker, it's not fine. Let's please clarify the two. One couldn't make this up. The Honourable Gentleman has stood for three supplementary questions and asked me an entirely different question, and he has disputed with me that the question he's asking now was not the question he asked in June. And with a greater respect, it is the same question. The question is, can the government say how many employees have the principal duty of the manning of the primary care front line desk? How many workers in front of the government are currently working in the primary care centre counter? Not the primary care centre, the primary care centre counter. The next question is, how many public servants or employees, in other words, he's asking the same question again in the other one, have as a principal duty the manning of the primary care frontline desk? And he asked, how many workers employed by government and companies, authorities and agencies, not employed by government, are working in the primary care centre counter? They are exactly the same questions.
The Honourable Dr. Cortez, in his answer to question 352, said, Mr. Speaker, I have taken the liberty to include counter in the plural, as there are many counters in the primary care centre, and it was not clear which one was being referred to. And this is obvious. Anyone visiting, going as a patient to the site, would see that in each of the coloured areas and elsewhere in that building, there are reception counters which are being manned by nurses and so on. It's all over the primary care centre. But it's what Dr. Cortez was pointing out.
Very much.
But I thought, my view was that the question should be allowed because it wasn't entirely clear from our assessment here, the clerk and myself, that we should rule it out. And therefore, I tend to give the benefit of the doubt usually to members of the opposition. They may not always think that I do. And then I would expect the minister, if he thinks that it's the same answer to the same question, to say so in the answer.
The reason why I'm arguing the point is only because you should have argued with me. I really don't want to quibble. If what the Honourable Gentleman actually wants to know
is what he asked in his supplementary, that I'm perfectly happy at not coming back to work in the next question time. Perfectly happy to write to him to be in the answer.
Well, thank you very much. The position is that all I want to know is how many employees are backing up front like this. That is all I want to know. And I want to know what the division is between public servants and employees of recruitment consultants. It's very simple. And if you could provide me with that information, I'd be very grateful. Because reading the answers that were provided by Dr. Cortez, I'm not sure that she has, in fact, provided me with the answer, except that overall, 11.
That is exactly correct. What I'm telling him is that the question he's asking me in the supplementary today is the same question he asked Dr. Cortez, also by way of supplementary, but that the question he asked me in the order paper within the last 6 months and today are also the same questions. In other words, he asked questions in the order paper which were answered by the Honourable Dr. Cortez. He's not satisfied with that answer, and he therefore asked a particular breakdown in supplementary, which obviously I read before I came to the house. But if that's the information he wants to have, I'm happy to give it to him by way of writing.
We now move to question 914. The questioner is the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the Canada government confirm the total cost of running the Hong Kong office by reference to salaries, benefits, rent expenses, including flights, and all other costs relating to the office's representation in the region?
Answer the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister. Yes, Mr. Speaker, the total cost of running the government of the Volta office in Hong Kong is £400,000 per year. This includes salaries, benefits, rent expenses, and flights.
to Jersey, to Guernsey, to the British Virgin Islands, to the Isle of Man has gone off more than something. And the opposition is telling the private sector today that for £400,000, Gibraltar shouldn't have an office in Hong Kong. I think it's absolutely incredible. And just your mic. Just your mic. And you mentioned the Honourable Minister of Financial Services said yesterday of contracts. I didn't. I said about one transaction. One transaction that did not come through because of the budget. But of course, there are many other transactions that have come through and that have happened. And there are businesses all over the world today working with Hong Kong and China that weren't before we opened the office. So I think the Honourable Members should think before they open mouth and engage going before the German speaker, because it's absolutely striking that if £400,000 this government has represented for the whole of China, and basically that's a bit too far. Absolutely striking.
Everyone in Gibraltar wants Hong Kong to be a success. Of course we do. We all want inward investment. The question, oh, copy on this, please. And what we want to do is to make sure that the money going into this project delivers results for the economy. That's what we want to do. Speaker, that didn't sound to me like a question. That sounded to me like an attempt to wiggle off a hook that the Honourable Gentleman has made for himself. Because he has had to face the inevitable logic of what the Minister for Financial Services has told him. Because after Brexit, is it that they don't realise that we will not be able to trade so easily with the rest of the European Union, and that we will have to trade with the rest of the world? And that one of the biggest opportunities for trade is with China, and that having an office in China is exactly what we should be doing. Now, if they are saying that it should cost less than £400,000, Mr. Speaker, I will bring to this House next time that they write anything they did which cost less than £400,000. Because they didn't do anything in England or in the United Kingdom that cost less than £400,000. The furniture that they bought for some of the rooms in Gibraltar House in London cost more than £400,000. Was it that they don't realise the legacy that they are carrying into this House? Mr. Speaker, a hole in the ground where there used to be a theatre cost £9 million. That is the sort of education that we have to take from them.
May I suggest, Honourable Members, we move on to the next question, really. We now move to questions to the Honourable the Chief Minister. We commence with question 915, the Honourable Ian Pinkney.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please advise what are the ministerial and parliamentary allowances for 2016-17, and why have these not yet been updated on Parliament's website?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the information requested has now been uploaded on the government website. Nevertheless, I now hand over a schedule with the information requested by the Honourable Gentleman.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Chief Minister for the schedule and information around what is required that the Parliament Board has been updated. Just to confirm my map, that the Chief Minister of the Earth in the South will have the standard public sector pay increase of 2.75%.
Mr. Speaker, I believe so. I believe that's the way it's applied across the board, and that's the way it's always applied. And I believe, just to confirm my math, that given that we're here on average 3 days a month and that we don't sit in 2 months of the year, that would make about 30 days, which means that the leader of the opposition is earning about £2,000 a day that he comes upon. Apparently, from what I heard in the Twitter post, he thinks that's part-time wages.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I say it still has to be my question, but I take it that, of course, is not a strong point, so we're not asking any more questions when it comes to calculation.
Mr. Speaker, it may not be my strong point according to him, but I realize that he doesn't think I have any strength. But 30 times 2 is one I can do quite easily.
Question 916, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Would the government agree that it's inappropriate for political election manifestos to be uploaded to government and government agency websites?
And to the Honourable Chief Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, it depends on the circumstances. For example, if the Parliament were to upload the manifestos of all political parties contesting an election, that would seem appropriate. Once a party wins an election, the manifesto in fact becomes a programme for government. Although I have heard some people say the manifesto is just a wish list, but I'm speaking for myself and my country. There might be a good argument, in fact, that it should then be uploaded to the government website so that citizens can check that the political party that won the election is delivering on its commitment. There could be other relevant circumstances where it might also be appropriate, and some where it might not be.
I'm grateful for giving this answer. I wonder whether you would think that having the 2011 DSLP manifesto on the DHA website is appropriate. I can direct members to the DHA website now this week, dha.gi, on the media, on the general publication. I'm grateful that you've been to the finish.
Mr. Speaker, my answer remains exactly as I set out, and if that decision has been made in order to set out what our agenda for the DHA was in 2011, I think it's a point we made, and in fact, I didn't realize, Mr. Speaker, until the Honourable Gentleman asked the question, that we haven't uploaded the 2011 and the 2015 manifesto to the government website. I think it is in the interest of citizens that they see that the government elected in 2011 has delivered on its programme, that the government elected in 2015 is delivering on its programme, and I shall ensure that the election and the manifestos of all parties that still provide them online are uploaded to the relevant government website as soon as possible.
Agrees that it is entirely appropriate for DHA to have a typical manufacturing website and that the government has no intention of removing it.
But speaking of the Honourable Government, he exactly wants to hear the answer that I'm giving him. But in fact, what I'm saying to him is that I'm grateful that he's pointed it out, because I'm going to have uploaded to the government website and to the DHA website the election winning manifestos of all the political parties that have them available digitally, which means that people will see that when the parties on this side of the House win elections, they deliver against their manifestos, and when the parties on that side of the House, I said parties because I have a preference for the other lady, but she hasn't been in government yet, she may yet do what she says if she ever wins an election. When the party on that side of the House has won elections, it has regarded its manifestos as what Venerable, the former Chief Minister, known to some on that side of the House as the greatest libertarian of all time, said that manifestos were a wish list, and people would be able to see on the DHA website, on the government website, and every other website that the government has, that we deliver and they don't.
Okay. Can I just ask, is this common practice in other Western democracies? Do the UK provide their manifesto on government websites? How does it work exactly?
Mr. Speaker, the position in other democracies is not something I can answer for right now. It may be that some do and some don't. But this is a simple democratic issue, and I'm very grateful that the Honourable Government has brought it up, because people are voting for something, and during a general election campaign, it is just party political material. It's out there for people to see. That's why I suggested that again, at general election time, what we should do is have all the political manifestos uploaded to the Parliament website. And in my view, the Parliament website might be very appropriately updated by providing a PDF of all the political manifestos of all time, so that people can see what has been said before. Now, when a party wins an election, that manifesto, which is the manifesto of the political party, in our view, becomes the program for government. It becomes the route map for government. And therefore, I think it is entirely appropriate that people should then be able to look at it, and your members should then be able to look at it, without the party that is responsible simply getting rid of it from its website and hoping that people lose the hard copy and not being able to hold it to account. Now, honourable members obviously have access to our magnificent manifesto, both the first one, which is the strongest, the New Dawn manifesto, and the second one, the strongest foundation manifesto. I promise them an even better one for the next general election. They ask us questions about that manifesto. Why would they object that the general public should have easy access to what we have said we are going to do, so that the general public, and not just they, can then point out that we may be failing, or actually point out that we are delivering? Why should something live on the ether and not be easily accessible? And Mr. Speaker, I'm quite happy, in fact, to also upload members of opposition members' manifestos, so that the public can have access to them, not just on the Parliament website, but also on the government website, because then people will be able to go back and see some of the nonsense that people have defended in the general election.
So, may I suggest a few things that he also publishes the lovely glossy pictures in his magnificent, so described by him, of the schools on the Bayside website.
Mr. Speaker, I'm delighted to do so, because it would be much better copy than what they provided in Rook.
Question number 917, the Honourable Alan King.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please explain why PAYE questions in October 2016 fell to 6.59 million as opposed to the average of 10.91 million per month for the previous 9 months?
Answer the Honourable Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, according to the monthly statistics published by the Income Tax Office in relation to the amount of PAYE tax collected per month in 2016, which are available on the government's government website, the amount of PAYE tax collected in October 2016 amounted to 9.35 million. Although not significantly below the calculated year-to-date average of 10.91 million, there are nevertheless a number of factors that contribute to variances in the amount of the PAYE tax collected. Examples include changes in remuneration and staffing levels within employers in Gibraltar, in addition to the timing of when payment of PAYE are made. Under the Income Tax Policy and Regulation of 1989, employers are required to settle their PAYE tax deducted from employees on or before the 15th day of the following month, and therefore changes in employer payment patterns would offset the collection year for that month with a corresponding increase in notable subsequently.
Mr. Speaker, very pleased to receive an answer. So, given that the reduction represents something like a 39% reduction month to month, is the Speaker and the Income Tax Office satisfied that there is no underlying problem in respect to PAYE collection?
Speaker, can only represent a 39% fall if we take the figure that he's provided? If we take the figure that I've provided, I don't think it represents 39%.
And Speaker, I'm using the, I hope I'm using the same figure to do that, if I downloaded from the government website, updated 31/2016, or Income Tax Office, it says gross receipts for 10.79 million in September, and gross receipts for 6.59 million in October, and that is a reduction in the surplus. Now, my question is there any concern in the Income Tax Office that there is a problem?
Mr. Speaker, I think we're going to need to listen to what I've said. The figure that I've been provided to the House is 9.35 million, and I've then given an explanation to say it's not 6.59 million.
And Mr. Speaker, may I ask whether the Chief Minister's update is a certain number, is it dated later, or is it in the number directed by tax office? Yes, I did download the schedule from the government's website only a couple of weeks ago. I'm going to read what I've been given again to London and Sentinel with the benefit of hearing it again. According to the monthly statistics published by the Income Tax Office in relation to the amount of COA tax collected per month since 2016, which are available in the Majesty, the Government Visitor's website, the amount of COA collected in October 2016 amounted to £9.35 million. That's what I have been given. Mr. Speaker, I actually handed the updated schedule by my colleague, and it looks like the statistics on the website were updated on the 15th of December, which then reflects the number of citizens of the country of 9.35 million, and then in November, 10.7 million. So I apologize to the House if there have been any mistakes on my part, but certainly those are the numbers that were on the wrong website.
Question number 918, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please name the professional advisers for whom the Chief Minister is trying to arrange the Netherlands meeting for the opposition in respect to the £300 million loan raised by Gibraltar Capital Assets Limited?
On to the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the professional advisor will include the Financial Secretary, the Directors of Gibraltar Capital Assets Limited, and the Company's Legal Advisor.
Mr. Speaker, I can't speak in full answer. So, from that list, then I'll take it to be nobody from James Stock and the promotion bank, the investment bank.
You can visit the room, Mr. Speaker, a few costs for the taxpayer to serve a chapter in the ability.
Mr. Speaker, I know personally in a possibility that we're trying to run to gather together all the individuals. Financial Secretary is obviously at his disposal, the Directors of the Company, as you know, at his disposal, and the legal advisor, I presume, or one, namely the Crown, which has a junior also in Gibraltar. So I wonder what was the difficulty in arranging the meeting.
No, I'm not allowing that supplementary. Nothing.
I apologize for Mr. Speaker. May I ask the names of the legal advisors to be present?
For Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman seems to have a very low regard for the level of the complexity of the work that the people who are referred to do and their travel schedules. Because, for example, the company's legal advisor is the founder of the GSD, Simon Bolivar, who has a considerable practice and profound, which takes him out of the jurisdiction often, and he's not somebody who can be available at drop of a hat to meet with retired bankers. The directors of the Gibraltar Capital Assets Limited include James Levy, for example, who is, as we all know, one of the engines of the Gibraltar economy, all on his own. And the Financial Secretary, of course, the other thing is at my disposal, but I respect people greatly, and I don't expect them to behave as they were said. With my busy day and their busy day, finding a vector which allows all of us to be present has not been easy. When did you revise and mention one person? Is that the only person who's present from her family? James Levy is going to be present from her family. Do you think that it is going to be present from her
background, but we know that he has senior people working with him on this matter. But I'm not going to ask him to bring all his seniors. I think that between people in danger, we'll be able to field honourable member questions. And of course, the leader of the position, I think, so will also be present, and he will also come up on. This is my final comment in this presentation. I'm grateful to Chief Minister for the participants of the meeting. I notice that all of them are residents in the water, and I hope they're all Mr. Speaker, the government is not responsible for the residents of people, and I didn't accept the question. But I'm delighted that one of the gentlemen at least agrees with me that all those I've mentioned are residents of Gibraltar. I don't know where his line of questioning is going, or whether he's a question that he has been going up and sending a line of questioning with a comment, which of course would be entirely outside the rules of the House.
Question number 919, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, will the government undertake to make a ministerial statement in January 2017 in respect of its financial performance as compared to the 2016-17 estimate for the 6 month period to 30th December 2016?
Aaron, to the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will make a statement to the House of the government's financial performance at budget time, and otherwise I will consider it appropriate to do so. Mr. Speaker, may I remind the Chief Minister that the Honourable colleague, Joe Bassan, on the 6th, gives to me updated positions in January in respect to the position that for September, I thought would be more appropriate for that to be in the way of a ministerial statement, but if so, which is I will table the question. Is that a preferred approach? Mr. Speaker, whatever he thinks of the report, it's not appropriate to entirely to him. What the government has agreed to do, and all of the government thinks is appropriate, is that they should have the information that we were given on a 6 monthly basis because he asked the question. And that is exactly what we will do. But what we're not going to do is make statements when he thinks that we should make statements outside of budget time in relation to the financial position of the government. The last time I did that, Mr. Speaker, when I was faced with the doomsday memory from the former financial secretary, and I have to explain to people the dire situation in which they have left the public financial division.
Next question. Question number 920, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, has the Walter Home Loans Limited applied for an obtained license from the Financial Services Commission under the Financial Services Investment and Fiduciary Services Act in respect of acting as a mortgage creditor within the meaning of the Financial Services Mortgage Credit Regulation 2015?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the Walter Home Loans Limited has not applied for license. Mr. Speaker, if the Chief Minister could perhaps confirm our understanding this side of the House that defense to, I believe, the Honourable Mr. Simon mentioned that at least one mortgage had been granted by this company, would he not agree then that he needs to apply for license? Absolutely not, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, may I ask him what grounds? Mr. Speaker, that the company is giving mortgages to its employees and therefore that he took that for license. Mr. Speaker, I'm saying that Walter Home Loans have no employees, and the Chief Minister is telling me now that it has employees. That it's a vehicle through which the government provides loans to its employees. It's perfectly normal for any employer who offers this sort of financial benefit is able to do so through an SPV, and that's what it's doing. Now the Chief Minister has received advice in respect to that particular point. I want to ask what advice he is, and if not, he has other advice. Mr. Speaker, the government does not reveal the content of its advice, and therefore does not need to reveal whether it has taken advice. That is the third one of the gentleman, simply to the Financial Services Mortgage Credit Regulations 2016, and he might try to read them, and then he would realize that anybody who reads English wouldn't need the legal advice in order to reach the conclusion I have reached.
Mr. Speaker, is there a reason why the government is treating this particular company different from other government-owned companies? Because really what he is saying is that for the purposes of the provision of loans to public servants, there is no difference between the government and its government-owned company, namely this particular company. Now, we've had exchanges across the floor of the House on many, many, many occasions, and his main defense to all the political points that we have made in that respect has been it's a government-owned company, it's not the government, ergo, for example, it's a debtor-based company, has nothing to do with the government. I mean, in this particular case, he is choosing to treat the company as if it were the government.
Mr. Speaker, he mischaracterizes the position the government has taken in relation to that debate. He's giving it the characterization he wishes to give it. That is not the position the government has taken, and therefore the rest of his analysis is not one in which I need to comment.
Speaker, on what basis does the government treat this particular company as an emanation of the government? Because that's what it's doing in this particular case. That's the only reason why he has proffered for this company not requiring any kind of license. He is saying, well, these are public servants, and the loans are being provided to public servants by this company, and because they're public servants, they're employees of the government, therefore, it's providing loans to its own employees. Well, they're not loans to its own employees, they're loans to the government. Now, what basis does he treat this particular company as the government?
I don't think one of the gentlemen has ever detached himself enough from himself to hear what he says in the context of the debate that we've had. All of the companies that we're talking about, the ones that he likes to talk about and characterize in a particular way, all of them are government-owned companies. Who has ever said that they're not government-owned companies? The whole debate is based on the fact that they are government-owned companies. Mr. Speaker, when he alights on that point, he might realize the answer that he's asking for now is one that becomes quite obvious.
He hasn't answered the question. Of course they're government-owned companies. This is a government-owned company. There is a government-owned company. But he's treating this particular government-owned company as if it didn't exist, as if it's just simply some kind of an agent of the government or something of that nature, or piercing the corporate veil to the thing that you will understand. A company as separate corporate personality, separate entity, that's the arguments that you use many, many occasions, to the government. Now, what basis did you treat this particular company as an emanation of the government? In other words, their government for the purpose of providing loans, which would then mean that it wouldn't require any
Mr. Speaker, years from now, when you and I sit around as friends and have copies rereading the handouts of the battles that we had in Parliament, he will feel this ever so faintly ridiculous when we read back that documentary. Why am I treating this company as if it doesn't exist? Well, Mr. Speaker, at least I understand why it is that he had to remove all those chairs from the Charles Town Club in order to defend it with faith. And why it is that he won't conduct a morale survey in the DOC. Mr. Speaker, a government-owned company giving loans to government employees is what we're dealing with. It's that simple, Mr. Speaker. And then Mr. Speaker, we'll have a brandy taste after the coffee in the dinner. And that's going to have some freedom. And that might be all right, Teddy.
Mr. Speaker, if I may return to the original thrust of the question.
My understanding is from the information given by the Honourable Mr. Fofana to the Board of Home Loan Committee is that no one in Gibraltar would be left without a mortgage if they so needed one, given the potential constriction of mortgages in Gibraltar by lending banks. So what do you think to agree with me is if any applicant to Gibraltar Home Loan Committee was not an employee of the government, but he would not be able to accept the loan until you're obtaining this license. Mr. Speaker, in principle, yes.
Mr. Speaker, I think that's the one who is not. Thank you.
Thank you for that last passing comment, which didn't include a question. Mr. Speaker, if the Honourable Gentleman has wanted to develop the issue and say, can we therefore be happy to note that nobody would have been happy to get up and say yes. Mr. Speaker, so in order to provide the privilege of all questions, I am going to ask a question. Go ahead, yes. I'd love. In order not to leave the people of Gibraltar without alone from this wonderful country, from a wonderful program, this wonderful chief minister of office, to a wonderful people of Gibraltar, will he apply for license in the event of people who need such a license? In principle, yes, and I'm greatly able to thank the gentleman who's recognized and thanked for Christmas, how wonderful to be.
Question number 921, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide a list of money lenders licensed under the Financial Services Money Lending Act as at the 1st of September 2016?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, my answer remains to set out the questions 389 and 442 of 2015. The details of the question are not in the public domain, but I'm again prepared to provide these details on a strictly confidential basis with the Honourable Member of Room. There are currently 19 money lending licenses currently in issue. I remain happy to consider making a provision to publish the list generally in future. I'm grateful to the Chief Minister. Will you attend to the money lending rules in respect of the application for license? And it actually requires the application to be rejected when application is required or rejected. And if an applicant's name is public and yet there is no registered license holder, I can find nothing in the money standards rules of money lenders to say that such a list of license holders should not be made public. I therefore invite the Chief Minister to consider whether perhaps it would be appropriate to make such a list public. From the figure of the question, he said in his last minute, he had his ears open when I answered his first question, because the last sentence I read says, I remain happy to consider making provisions to publish the list in future. And my answer to question 389 of 2015 ended with, I think it would be proper that list would be publicly available so no other public can access. We have access to it. Perhaps on the government website, and we need every year the license to change if you're not changing. I have absolutely no difficulty with dealing with that issue, dealing in the dealt in a way that is one that gives access to the public. The public are the ones who have the service of borrowing money offered to them by these companies. Many of them may or may not advertise their service. And so I see no reason why there shouldn't be a provision that this list should be published. And in the same way that the Honourable Gentleman says, there's nothing to stop us from publishing a list, there's nothing requiring us to that we're going to publish a list or advertising to a lender that we are going to publish a list. I think the conclusion I reached when I last discussed this with a member of the was then Damon Bettina, not my team, so one of the three doctors who's left the DSU since the last general election, and another one. Since the last general election, Rome, Mr. Sunrise, that's four out of seven, that's worth ratio than 3 out of 85. But anyway, the way I left it then, in the future, was that I was planning to discuss with a member of the in the antechamber how to give effect to a mechanism to publish this list and think it's appropriate and could be something that we do. Would you then undertake to publish this list within the Life Family Department? Mr. Speaker, because we have different political information, I don't envisage, and we don't work in the same firm when we're in practice, I don't envisage that he and I would be having coffee and brandy in the future. Perhaps we will, and who knows, we've enjoyed things in the past when we were both students in the Students' Association. But I think, again, he will want to look at the handbill and see what I said, and understand that this question I don't think is one that is relevant, because I said I'm quite happy to discuss with him in the antechamber how we might be able to do this. So I'm not going to give an undertaking to do something that he and I have not yet discussed how we might do. The word undertaking has a particular meaning to a lawyer, at least to those of us who mean what we say, and therefore I'm not going to give an undertaking, but I'm quite happy to agree to discuss it with him in the antechamber and to try and find the mechanism to give effect to the idea that there should be a risk public. Mr. Speaker, of what they are instructed by the Chief Minister regards my opinion, I don't see what discussions of what we have in there that would make it easier for him to publicly list. I therefore don't see any point in meeting in the Empty Chamber, but again, I would ask him to consider publishing this list sooner rather than later.
Mr. Speaker, there are some things in my field that are just hanging on the table against the table. Mr. Speaker, I refer the honourable gentleman to the answer I gave a few moments ago. I think that's the appropriate term of answer in the Parliament.
Mr. Speaker, is the government satisfied that 10 business days with a submission date of the 22nd of December 2016 is sufficient time for interested parties in expressing an interest to submit a proposal to lease its vehicle fleet, and if so, why the urgency? I will answer this question together with questions 923 to 925.
Question 923, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please identify the media outlet in which the official notice inviting the persons of interest for the leasing of vehicle fleet was placed, including the number of days placed and the date?
Question number 924, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise why it is seeking an expression of interest in respect of the leasing of the entire vehicle fleet, comprising over 400 vehicles, motorcycles, and 90 specialist vehicles?
Question number 925, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise what was the policy decision to be taken on the, I quote, future of the garage and workshop, end quote, referred to by the people auditor in a conversation with the Chief Executive Officer of the Technical Services Department in paragraph 3.5.4 of the Principal Auditor's Report for 2014-15.
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government does consider that 10 business days is sufficient for interested parties to register an expression of interest with regard to leasing the fleet, and one would have assumed that to be an obvious answer, given that that is the time the government has allowed. The advocate for the expression of interest for the leasing of the government vehicle fleet, and it was published in the Walter Chronicle and Panorama on Tuesday, the 22nd of November 2015. The speaker, the consequence of the garage and workshop section collective agreement, an early exit scheme agreed by the previous administration, the operation of the department has become extremely difficult due to the drain of skilled staff. As a consequence, we're looking at other models to deliver the service. One such model that would ensure that HMDOT has a safe, fully operational fleet would be the leasing of vehicles from the private sector. A leasing option would include the full servicing, repair, and replacement of the vehicle, ensuring that public sector employees have the best possible resources to carry out their duties. We are currently in discussions with the United Union on how best to introduce these changes in a way that will not have a negative impact on the workforce. The future of the garage and workshop has been under review for a considerable number of years in order to identify the most efficient model for the future. The current expressions of interest recently advertised for the leasing of vehicles also form part of the overall review of the garage and workshop. Once these are received, the government will be in a better position to decide on what options will provide the most efficient and best value for money. In terms of this transaction agreement, I know you're able to clarify anything, but it appears to be a fair release back. Would it be correct that the first stage of this transaction is that the government would de facto sell their entire fleet to whether it was the successful tender and then lease back the same vehicles on whatever terms they will do in future? Mr. Speaker, I don't know what the expressions of interest will result in. That may or may not be one of the ways that it is proposed by those who express an interest that matters to the debtors. People won't be speaking to not accept that in the first instance the government should receive a sum of money for 400 odd vehicles. Mr. Speaker, that is one way in which it may happen, it may happen in another way. I'm going to speak of the 2 minutes, I have an idea of what that other way might be.
because I frankly cannot see how you would effectively dispose of your entire vehicle fleet under no consideration.
Is the Honourable Chief Minister think there may be other ways of doing this other than disposing of the fleet?
Mr. Speaker, coming back to the expression of interest, I actually have a copy of the term, and one of the special vehicles includes VIP vehicles, including the Chief Minister's vehicle. If we established yesterday that there is only one provider in Gibraltar that can service the Chief Minister's vehicle, are we not really talking about one provider that has already been identified, and hence why there is only 10 days in which to express an interest?
No, Mr. Speaker, because different providers could deal with taking that vehicle to the provider that provides the services for that vehicle. So the driver government may realize that the government's vehicle fleet goes very wide indeed, and there are some vehicles there that are provided by other providers, which is not that provider that he seems to have wanted to identify, and the provider that provides the service may have to go to other providers in the context of servicing. It's not just the G1 Tesla that can really be dealt with by one particular garage. There are many vehicles that the government has that can only be provided for in one particular garage, in particular the modern vehicles. And if the Honourable Gentleman wants to put his thinking cap on for more than the moment that it's taken to try and come up with that, he might realise that some of the other VIP fleet on the Mercedes is provided for by another provider, and the only person that's going to have the computer is going to be the Mercedes and the Mercedes dealer.
Would you give me an idea as to when you may want to put into place this type of transaction? Is it within the first quarter next year, second quarter? Is there a time frame?
I have an idea, but I'm not going to ask you my idea.
Do you have a concrete date as to when a decision will be taken as to whether the expressions of interest be accepted or maybe none at all?
Mr. Speaker, doesn't have a concrete date for when he will take a decision is not something that I think leads the House anywhere other than just to hypothesis and speculation as to when something might happen. When something happens, Mr. Speaker, there will be an announcement, and then the Honourable Gentleman will be able to quiz us on what has happened. But until then, we can't ask us for a timetable, which we impose upon ourselves so that we can then check upon it.
Mr. Speaker, I take a slightly different line on my supplementary. In terms of the guarantee workshop, how many jobs are there?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the number of jobs at risk is really not something that I can answer. It's a question that we should ask the man that has been referred to by some on that side of the House as the greatest civil servant of all time. It is a collective agreement that gave rise to redundancies that were unsigned by them, I think, a few days before they called the general election of 2011. It's the collective agreement between the Gibraltar government tonight and the Gibraltar Mechanical and Electrical Services Limited, which provided for people to leave on an early exit basis and for those who were employed in a government department to be moved to a company. The government is not envisaging any particular number of redundancies or anything like that. We are left with the agreement for redundancies that they signed.
Mr. Speaker, returning to the question about the fleet, the Honourable Chief Minister was implying, perhaps I got it wrong, I'm asking you about this, that what might be envisioned is a transaction involving Mercedes going to one particular garage or a deal with one particular garage in relation to Mercedes in relation to the others. A different garage. Is that what the government is considering, or is what he is saying that it will go to one particular entity, and that entity will then have carriage assembling of a savings, for example, subcontracted to the Mercedes garage?
But this, I wasn't interested in anything. I was dealing with the hypothesis that was put by the Honourable Member to his left. I am waiting to see what the expressions of interest providers are, the people who have proposed this to the government and inside the government, and to see what is proposed and what is best for the taxpayer. Once that happens, we will be in a position to make an assessment of what is
in our best collective interest. What I was dealing with was the point the honourable member colleague was making to suggest that there was only one potential provider of these services because one vehicle has to be serviced by them. I gave you the example of five vehicles that have to be serviced by somebody else. Mr. Stewart, in my last supplementary, if the government has, the government receives no expressions of interest, what would be the fallback position? Would it be just continue as it is with Zane Garrett and then please control it?
Mr. Speaker, that is a hypothetical question, and I don't think it is appropriate that I'm getting involved in answering a hypothetical question.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to the question of the redundancies, and of course, if Gibraltar government and the new administration coming in 2011 felt that it was something unfair in the collective agreements that had been negotiated by the DOD administration, it was always open for them to try and renegotiate. But, Mr. Speaker, obviously I would have envisaged that any early retirement that had been taken by people under that collective agreement would have probably been taken shortly after 2011, 2012, 2013. But is it saying that there are still individuals that can take up the terms of that collective agreement that was negotiated in 2011? Or is he saying that there is nobody employed by the garage, they're all employed for a company? And I haven't understood the answer that he has provided. Could I ask you to clarify?
It would have to be a specific notice of some aspect of that question. But I can tell him that nobody is employed by the garage because then he would make a suggestion to a transfer to Gibraltar Mechanical and Electrical Services Limited.
If I understand, I understand that. But the honourable gentleman, in an answer that he provided to my honourable friend Mr. Clinton, he referred to this collective agreement. Now, unless what the honourable gentleman is just simply doing is making a political point, which is the stupid that I have to say, because it doesn't take matters any further, there must be some relevance to the collective agreement and the position today. Because the question, as I understand, that was made by Mr. Clinton was, does he envisage that there's going to be any forms of redundancy, loss of jobs, whether it's not in the barrel, but it's in this particular company. And therefore, there has to be a link, unless there is none, and just simply wanted to mention the collective agreement that we negotiated between the position today and the collective agreement. And I just wonder, if we can return to the original question, which was, well, how many are there going to be any government visits that there are going to be any people that are going to be taking out redundancies or are going to be left of jobs in this particular country?
Mr. Speaker, to provide a political answer to a political question in a parliament seems to me to be exactly what we have been elected to do and are here to do. And there doesn't seem to me to be a key stop to remind them of the general. They signed an agreement in relation to this particular department, which then saw all employees transferred to a company for this. So this does seem to me as if it is becoming clearer and clearer that he had very little idea of what it was that was happening on the floor above where he used to work. But the reason why it has been referred to is because the first question, not supplementary, the first question that was put in relation to the subject was, can the government advise why it is receiving expressions of interest? Where did the figure receiving expressions of interest? For the reason I read out in my first answer, which relates to the fact that this has been needed the garage of all employees who moved to the company and a lot of them in early exercises. Well, Mr. Speaker, that's the position. If he doesn't like the answer, he shouldn't ask the question. But let's be clear, I am not envisaging anything at this stage. I've asked for expressions of interest. Once we receive those expressions of interest, we can make an assessment of those expressions of interest, and I've already said that we're doing so with the unions. So I don't understand where it is that you think to yourself.
Mr. Speaker, where I'm going is I'm trying to understand the answers that the Honourable Gentleman has provided. And he has said something now in answer to my supplementary, which I think takes the matter further. I don't know whether it's a slip of the tongue or not, but what he has just told me is because of this collective agreement, there was a de-reading of employees at the garage, they went into a company,
they were employees that took up early retirement in accordance with the collective agreement. And because of labour shortage, this is the implication of what he is saying, because of labour shortage, really the job can't be done properly in relation to the servicing of the fleet of Christ. And that's the reason. If I understand it, that's the reason why the government is now effectively looking at expressions of interest in order to do that. Now, that is true. Many people, we then have a situation, and it is not true, we have a situation where those employees in that company that formerly were involved in the servicing of these vehicles or working with these vehicles, obviously would be, and effectively an inverted commas, redundant because they wouldn't be doing the job that they're doing at present. And therefore, my question is, well, what does the government envision is going to happen with those individuals if this particular initiative reaches fruition and a company that is in fact engaged by the government in order to service these particular vehicles?
Everything that he has said, I would agree with. Even the idea that people could, in effect, become redundant because of what the government is trying to do. That is completely contrary to the position the government expects will be the case. But we are waiting to see what the expressions of interest say. But he started his supplementary, Mr. Speaker, by saying, now I have taken matters further by saying that the numbers have been reduced and the operation has been denuded by the early exit scheme. Well, Mr. Speaker, I've only taken matters further. In that respect, if you didn't hear what I said in respect of my first answer, because what I said was this, as a consequence of the Garrison Workshop section, collective agreement and early exit scheme agreed by the previous administration, the operation of the department has become extremely difficult due to the drain of skilled staff. As a consequence, we are looking at other models to deliver service. So I started with that, and that's exactly what I said now. I didn't take matters further, but although perhaps he might have perked up his ears and started listening late in the day.
Question 926, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Service to question 199 of 2016, can the government confirm what tangible effective progress is being made to the so-called Project India?
On to the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, considerable amount of work has been undertaken in respect of developing the relationship between Gibraltar and India. Specific announcements will be made when appropriate.
Take it from that response that remains within the time of this Parliament.
Well, Mr. Speaker, yes. Although it may be that some of these things relate to things that will occur through the term of this Parliament and the future Parliament, and I or others may be making announcements about them, but for the good of the future of Gibraltar, those announcements I hope will be welcomed by members opposite, whether they are opposite or not.
And does the government envisage that it's going to be opening some kind of office in India or in that area in order to service any business emanating from that area?
If we do, we'll make an announcement, Mr. Speaker. If we don't, we won't.
He does, Mr. Speaker. Will he undertake that it will be advertised and he won't shoehorn any GSOP activists in the same way as he did with the Hong Kong office for 400,000 pounds? Excuse me, but there's no how to answer that question. I'm ruling it out of order. Go on to the next question.
I'm looking to see if I can have an opportunity. I'm sorry to remind the Honourable Gentleman that appointees to represent the Gibraltar government abroad are always appointed by the Chief Minister. It's not a process of advertising. I reminded him that he made those points that he likes to make about a man who used to have been considered a friend until he changed party. Mr. Speaker, that all ambassadors are appointed not as a result of interview processes, and although we don't have ambassadors, we have commercial representatives, they're appointed in the way that they were appointed under the GOC, now that the GOC or GSOP liberals are in power, except, Mr. Speaker, that it seems that when they do something, it's a perfectly proper and appropriate conduct of good government. And when we do something, we're shoehorning people into the difference, even though they are extraordinary, capable Gibraltarians
who have demonstrated abroad that they are world-class at what they do. But you know, Mr. Speaker, that sort of hypocrisy book delivered between low morale, as we now see amongst his supporters, that's why he has to create a runway in the centre of the Charles Plant room to pretend that it's passed. And that's why there are more doctors at the DHA, Mr. Speaker, than there were people in the Charles Plant room for the last 10 years.
Question 927, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
Before we start, and Stephen Beaton will come, I have to tell you. Wait. Is the government satisfied that the list of consultants retained by government published on the government website is accurate?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, when my call comes, it's probably going to go and become one of his partners, because I think this is going to come before mine, but never mind. But if they're left there, if there's any reason why we shouldn't be, then perhaps we care after that.
Question 928, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please state whether the ad hoc members of the Gibraltar Consultative Council have been appointed?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
But to speak, an announcement will be made when the ad hoc members of the Gibraltar Consultative Council are appointed.
Mr. Speaker, does he intend to gazette, for example, the appointment of the members of the Consultative Council?
Mr. Speaker, I don't know whether there is an obligation to gazette. I must gazette in the legislation. We recently passed it, but I don't have that level of detail. Because I think it's something that is really done as a requirement, but otherwise it's something that can be done by way of public statement. I have no view whether something should be just a gazette statement or a public statement. It is important that the people who form part of this very important consultative body should be known to the general public so that they realize just how eminent the people that I hope will be a part of it are, and I have no views one way or the other.
And has the Honourable the Chief Minister approached anybody in relation to potentially being a member of an ad hoc member of the Gibraltar Consultative Council, or is that not something that he hasn't got to that stage and therefore is something that he's going to be doing early next year or next year?
I haven't.
So I take it from that answer that he has identified the people that he wants as ad hoc members of the Gibraltar Consultative Council.
Mr. Speaker, I have identified them. I haven't spoken to all of those who are voting for them. Perhaps two supplementaries. One, just to confirm that the Consultative Council, even though they don't have a big vote member yet, have not met. As they have met, when did they meet? And secondly, the ad hoc members will be seeking to confirm they will be writing a formal letter of appointment, so not just a phone call.
Minister does not have to answer. My common sense tells me that you do not have to answer the first question. If members of the ad hoc committee, the ad hoc members have not been appointed, I haven't understood it. Please repeat it then.
Well, you haven't understood it because the point is that you don't need to have the ad hoc members in order for the Consultative Council to meet.
The answer is that since I am an ex officio member, I can answer the question myself, and therefore we can carry on with some other business, can we? I am an ad hoc member, I have not been called for any meeting, I haven't attended, and therefore the answer is it hasn't been.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker,
we'll get on to the second part of your question.
Mr. Speaker, respectfully, not an ad hoc member, you have to be a standing member. But not ad hoc. Yes, exactly, but that's not an ad hoc member. Mr. Speaker, I'd like to consider myself a person with some common sense, but my question is asking how the Consultative Council met without the ad hoc members. Simple as that. And you may, in your own capacity, be there in your own capacity, but my question is what is the government? Mr. Speaker, you're absolutely right, in particular now that the question has been clarified. If the council had met without the IPEC members, you would have been the first to know because they were supposed to hold a member. And therefore, you have clarified to your position that there has not been a meeting of this council. Mr. Speaker, I am happy to deal with the second renewal of renewable government as I said before. The whole thing will start with a phone call and it will end with a letter.
Question number 929, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Mr. Speaker, since the Honourable Gentlemen opposite have been in government, how many taxpayers have been sent notices in writing of the Commissioner of Income Tax's intention to publish details of their failure to comply with their legal obligations to pay tax?
On to the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, from December 2011 to date, 169 taxpayers have been sent notices in writing in relation to the Commissioner of Income Tax's intention to publish details of their failure to comply with their legal obligations to pay tax.
And Mr. Speaker, I take it from the fact that there has not, up to my knowledge anyway, been any publication of details that the fact that this notice has been sent has had the desired effect in all 169 cases.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I understand that 45 of these letters have gone sometime this month as part of the routine that the tax office has got into since we were elected. The time for a settlement of outstanding liabilities is Friday, the 13th of January 2017, for those 45. The Honourable Gentleman, therefore, cannot make that assumption about those 45, but I think he can safely make it about the ballot.
Question number 930, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please state whether there have been any new recruits within the police prison service this year?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir.
Thank you very much for the answer. Can the Honourable Chief Minister state how many recruits there have been in the police service this year?
Mr. Speaker, please, sir.
And Mr. Speaker, have they been recruited from the waitlisted individuals that were waitlisted? They were waitlisted for 6 months prior to March of this year, and then I think that the Honourable the Minister for Justice wrote to me and said that the waitlisting had been extended for another 3 months. I may have wrong whether it's 3 months or another 6 months, but can you answer whether they've been recruited from those people that have been waitlisted as opposed to outside that list?
Mr. Speaker, that's not a question of the rights and that's not a question of the rights and the person of the Honourable Gentleman wants that answer, he can ask me and I will get the information.
Question number 931, the Honourable D.A.
Mr. Speaker, how many vacancies were there across the public service, inclusive of government-owned companies or public authorities, as at the end of November 2016?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
My microphone is not on. I will answer with 9 seconds.
Question number 932, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please state, as at the end of November 2016, how many employees in the public sector, government-owned companies, authorities and or agencies were currently temporarily promoted, detailing acting posts, date temporarily promoted and the department?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
I have again reviewed the answers provided by the Human Resources Department and I am still not confident in the answers provided. Nevertheless, I am willing to give the Honourable Gentleman a copy behind the Speaker's chair of the information as it has been provided to me, and I will ensure that there is a satisfactory answer available for the next sitting, because I think it is important that we get to the bottom of what is wrong with him. If he agrees, I will provide him on a off the record without taking the information I've been providing, and I will explain to him why it is not satisfied with the answer.
nothing that I will say. We will leave the Chief Minister to provide me the information in any event. So I'm left with no alternative but to accept the offer that he has made. Obviously, Mr. Speaker, I will ask your indulgence when it comes to next time round to ask exactly the same question so that the answer is provided if it hasn't been provided in writing beforehand.
Because I expect that the other government should be able to ask that question, even though it's going to be within the 6 months period, because I'm saying it will be available in that time. But the other government says he's not going to move me, and that he has no choice but to accept. But remember that the choice I've given him, Mr. Speaker, is that I'm going to give him the information, as it has been given to me in confidence, on a, well, he and I would understand that without hope, it will become public of the next meeting. But in any event, I'm now very confident that it will be something that we can publish at the next meeting, because I expect to be able to get to the bottom of the issue.
Question number 933, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Naum.
With reference to the public announcement made by the Gibraltar Private Sector Workers and Pensioners Association in the Chronicle on the 13th of December, whereby they claim that government has failed in its manifesto commitments, both in 2011 and 2015, leaving them in, quote, hardship and misery, unquote, what does government propose to do to assist this association and earn its trust once again?
Answer the Honourable
Chief. Well, Mr. Speaker, we will comply with our manifesto commitment of 2015.
Mr. Speaker, I appreciate that. According to them, the government has already not complied with their manifesto commitment of 2011. And furthermore, they haven't complied as per this communique that the government sent on the 1st of April 2016 on the morning before their AGM, promising universal credit and an update to be issued by no later than Friday the 29th of April, which is about 8 months ago, and they still haven't heard. Furthermore, Michael Crome promised that whatever figure was agreed as extra financial assistance would be implemented in this financial year. So we have two commitments that have still not materialized. What would the Chief Minister have to say about that?
Well, Mr. Speaker, first of all, I would counsel her not to mention the name of civil servants in the context that she has today, or not the civil servant public servants. I understand that she has not been long in the House. The appropriate way to do this is to say a member of his staff rather than mention the name, but I entirely accept that is not something that's been done intentionally. Secondly, Speaker, I think it is not true to say, and I'm not suggesting that it is her that is in any way incurring an untruthfulness, that they haven't heard back. In fact, we've had meetings with them, as I understand it, since, although we have not perhaps written. But again, my mind is going to that it already happened since April 2016. The manifesto commitment, Mr. Speaker, doesn't just depend on the government, and this is perhaps an opportunity to highlight the independence of community care. Community care is a part of what the government is trying to structure in respect to this. But community care is independent and has its own views and needs its views taken into consideration and accepted. Finally, Mr. Speaker, what I would say is that this is a collective of people that has the government's sympathy, and it retains the government's sympathy despite the fact that this is an advert against the government. But we have great sympathy for that right. We are the only government that ever put this issue up. It is true that we've taken longer than we anticipated to deal with some of the concerns that they have, but we continue to be the only government in the history of Gibraltar that is prepared to deal with the matter of how individuals in the private sector find themselves, if not destitute, then certainly without a generous pension provision in old age. That's why we will continue not just to deal with the problem that they have, but also with the problem in the future for those who are employed in the private sector today to deal with the issue of compulsory pensions in the private sector. Again, something that is already in our manifesto. So I can fully expect, Mr. Speaker, that before the next general election, this collective will not just by then have been happy to see how the government is dealt with this matter, but long before then, and they will be very happy, in fact, with the way that we approach resolution to such an extent that I hope to be able to persuade them to place an advertisement in the Gibraltar Chronicle or any other newspaper that will carry it, congratulating the government for having been the only political government in the history of Gibraltar to address the I worry that they don't realize that this is not political politics. This is very embarrassing politics indeed. The government considers that this is an issue that must be dealt with, and it will be dealt with.
Speaker, thank you. I was having visions of myself with a pair of pom-poms, so thank you for your giving me some back with you. I still ask once again the Chief Minister what the association has installed on you to bring this up, because they claim that they haven't heard anything since Friday the 29th of April, which is the promise. And I ask the Chief Minister perhaps if he could contact them or make a commitment in this House to get in touch with them. Does he not consider it a very sad state of events that this association has had to resort to a public announcement talking about facing another Christmas of hardship and misery, and also asking about the fact that because of the lack of communication from government, a lot of them have actually had to resort to taking funds out of their debentures, and the effect of having to take out their funds from the debentures has crucified the savers because of the penalty that they have had to withstand. So can the Chief Minister give some kind of definite, timely commitment to speak to these people and give them some trust that they will actually abide by their promises?
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for giving us a confusing crucifixion and Christmas. But they're completely different holidays. They're completely different holidays. Mr. Speaker, the first thing is that I do not recognize that there is anyone in Gibraltar in this collective that is suffering hardship and misery by the measure that anyone else in Europe would understand that. And there are some people in Gibraltar who are not going to have as abundant a Christmas as others, and there are some people in Gibraltar who are in hardship and misery. I don't think that this collective genuinely considers the position it is in can say that they are in hardship and misery, or they don't say that there are some who might not be. Certainly, those who have briefed her, in my view, need to take the lead of her. See, what they're talking about is debentures. There aren't many people in hardship and misery that have debentures. Now, what the government wants to do is to put in place a system so that people don't have to dip into their savings, so that they are able to have, as I think they should have, an income that is dignified in their old age. She needs to know that when we started the discussion, what we were being asked for was that people who did not have a private pension scheme should, by the government, be given the equivalent of government occupational pension schemes of the sort that final salary schemes that the Liberals and I have had called to debate across the floor of the South, even though they have not been employees of the government. We've moved on a lot since then. That's why the leadership has come into the equation. I can tell the Liberal Lady that I know that we had a communication with this collective on the 30th of September of this year, so I don't accept the date of April as the date of final communication. I can also tell the Honourable Lady that I know and have a very high regard for the people in the committee that I'm referring to, and that I meet them on occasions in other guises and have discussed these issues. And so, therefore, she has the government's commitment that we will comply with our manifesto obligations. And this is not an issue where the government is trying in any way to avoid providing the additional income that we are committed to providing. But there are reasons why we cannot do it from the government, and we don't think that shouldn't. I ask her to refer in her mind to the reasons why community care was created. She may then understand why community care may be relevant and why there is now a third party in the equation that has to get comfortable with what the government might propose. And therefore, I am going to crave her indulgence in respect to this matter, but this is very much an issue on our agenda and one that will be dealt with. And I can just end by saying that, Mr. Speaker, I don't think that that it's appropriate to look at her as a cheerleader in any way, but there are some who might be best described as cheerleaders for the goal of failure, and they don't look very good in pom-poms either.
One final supplementary, if I may. Thank you for that information, Chief Minister. Can I just have a confirmation or not that as Kurdish government official what I have been told by the association, is the government willing to confirm that extra financial assistance for low-income pensioners will be implemented in this financial year as told by this official? And in case it's my last time to speak today, I want to take this opportunity to wish all the members of the House a very Merry Christmas. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, there are still motions today, and I look forward to hearing her views in respect of the motions, and the government has every intention of dealing with those before the end of the calendar year. So I'm sure that we'll still have an opportunity to hear her, although, of course, I reciprocated on behalf of this side of the House. Mr. Speaker, in this financial year seems to be the sort of target that we should be aiming for, and to have my undertaking, something I'm not going to be willing to give to you, that we shall certainly be doing our very best to ensure that we do comply with that commitment, because this is a collective that continues to have the government sympathy. I still think it is appropriate to highlight that we are the only government that has cared, we are the only party that has carried a commitment, and I might have said it's a bit unfair, therefore, that we should be pulled over the polls, but when people are, if not in the House and busy, especially in need, then I'm quite happy to be pulled over the polls and reminded that I have a commitment to do something because I am committed to delivering on this. Mr. Speaker, I just need to explain the great interest and the country for our speaking on the subject. I have, by true coincidence, a meeting with an individual who was affected by a scenario of being close to retirement, but not having a pension as they would have had in the public sector, if they had been employed in the public sector. My question is this, to somebody in that scenario who may be 1 year away from retirement, and my personal understanding, as Stephen has just said, is that in people in those circumstances where they won't benefit from a private sector pension, or 20 years might enter into tomorrow. If I understand it correct, what the speaker is saying is that the alternative means in which the assisted members would be some kind of arrangement in the community, but it would be inappropriate, as you said, for the government itself to stick its hand in the second. Well, the speaker, various things arise from that remark from one of the gentlemen. The first is that I assume he is such a person, as I don't understand that he has ever worked in the public sector, so he is such a person. He doesn't seem to me to be either in hardship or misery or penury, and therefore he shouldn't be, I hope, asking out of a vested interest that there may be some extra pennies coming his way. What we are proposing, and it is set out in our manifesto, is that in partnership with the Minister, a new additional financial support measure for pensioners will be brought in, because the target is the pensioner who needs that additional financial support. I thought we were quite explicit and have answered the question that he poses simply by referring to the manifesto that one would have thought he would have read during the context of the last general election contest. I'm surprised he seems not to have read that. But it's true to say, Mr. Speaker, that there is likely to be that provision in the context of the plan that I've indicated to the Honourable Lady. We are looking at their pamphlet of the last general election did not contain provision in that respect. And often you might want to tell the gentleman or lady that he met that the government will be providing that additional financial support measure for pensioners in those circumstances that he described, but not in his circumstances. I hope that I've made clear our continued commitment to comply with that obligation.
Speaking to the table, the answer to this question.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. I have the honour to table the answers to written question numbers W66 to W72 of 2016 inclusive. And the Speaker has the honour to move that the House should now adjourn until tomorrow at 4 p.m.
The House will now adjourn to tomorrow at 4 p.m.